It's not just Elon Musk, be they cabinet picks, ambassadors, or advisors. Donald Trump's roster of nominees stacked with a record number of billionaires. What does that say about the times we live in? And if Trump's first stint as U.S. president was anything to go by, it's safe to predict more deregulation and tax cuts that will serve his team nicely. But does success in making money imply success in serving the common good? 4 years ago, captains of industry and tech titans were distancing themselves from Trump's brand of politics after the storming of the Capitol to try and stop the January 6th certification of his defeat. That was then. This is now. Take last week's announcements by Facebook's boss Mark Zuckerberg that he was ditching fact-checkers on his platforms. Will kissing the ring be good for Meta? And will the rest of the world feel that the impact of what is happening both in business and politics across the Atlantic at a time when the world needs to come together on issues such as environmental norms, artificial intelligence? What response if it gets a bit, let's say, adversarial? Today in the France 24 debate, how much do billionaires rule going forward? With us from Washington, Jake Denton, research associate at the Heritage Foundation think tank's Tech Policy Center. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
From Arlington, Virginia, Christine McDaniel, senior research fellow at George Mason University's Mercatus Center. How would you describe the Mercatus Center?
Mercatus Center, thanks for having me. Mercatus is Latin for market. So market-oriented policy think tank.
All right, thanks for joining us. Pierre Gervais, professor of American civilization at the University of Sorbonne Nouvelle. Happy New Year to you.
Thank you.
And with us as well, Jakob Hassler, global head of consulting for the professional services firm Forvis Mazars. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Your reactions on the hashtag F24debate. Yeah, the confirmation hearings start in the morning on Capitol Hill. And while much of the media's attention will be squarely on controversial picks like Fox News personality Pete Hegseth to head the Defense Department, Tulsi Gabbard for intelligence director, will all that be overshadow the other big story, money? In Trump's first term, his cabinet already had a combined net worth of $3.2 billion, dwarfing the $118 million, with an M. That's the combined net worth of Joe Biden's outgoing team. There's Musk and others who don't strictly have cabinet posts. Note that both parties have historically rewarded wealthy donors with ambassadors' posts. And there you see some ambassadors in that list. The appointment for France also earned a pretty penny in his time. Number six on the list of rich people in Donald Trump's nominees is Howard Lutnick, for Commerce Secretary, the boss of the Wall Street trading firm Cantor Fitzgerald, co-chairing Trump's transition team. The pro-tariffs businessman is slated for Commerce, with fellow super-rich tip to take over education, treasury, energy. Is this, Jake Denton, just normal that so many billionaires are in the cabinet? Is this okay?
Well, you know, we're inheriting a very complex policy situation. Whether you look at California burning to the ground or North Carolina being flooded, we have, you know, thousands of Americans living in tents still. The middle of America has been gutted and deindustrialized. We need our best and brightest, our builders, to come to Washington and help enable the Trump administration to rebuild this country. So maybe it's not traditional, but we need our best and brightest to enlist and to push this country into a new age.
Are they the best and brightest at making money? Are they the best and brightest at running government?
Well, you know, it's great to have, you know, think tankers or, you know, policy papers and these types of things get into positions and run these agencies. But at the same time, we need people who have experience on the ground building. You know, these are people who have built businesses, who have built very successful industries here in the United States. And we need them in a position to restore our greatness.
Christine McDaniel, your thoughts on the way these nominees were picked?
Well, it's, yeah, this is a really up to the president-elect and his president-elect Trump's decisions. He made pretty clear that his priorities were immigration, you know, controlling the borders and bringing down inflation, among other things. This is the team he chose. He won the popular vote, the electoral vote. I think it really doesn't matter what we think, how he chose them. What matters is how and whether the policies that they enact will work. You know, and that's what I think they're working on really hard right now to try to design effective policy solutions.
Is it a conflict of interest appointing, for instance, as Commerce Secretary, the boss of a major Wall Street firm, Cantor Fitzgerald, one that's just bet heavily on crypto?
Well, look, I mean, there's always potential for conflicts of interest. You know, that's why there's a very particular vetting process. That's why it's so important to go through that vetting process properly. And I hope the President Trump and his close aides do that to protect President Trump down the road. It's the process is there to protect the president. But we had many cases where people come in and they, they don't make it through, or they make it through, but it's clear that, you know, it won't be appropriate for them to work in particular areas. That could be the case here.
Yeah, but how many will be rejected when you know that there are other low-hanging fruit, if you will, among controversial choices? The likes of, like we said, Tulsi Gabbard, Pete Hegseth for defense, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. for health secretary. I mean, the billionaires will all get through, won't they?
I don't think anything is a done deal. The Senate has made clear that, you know, they're watching this, taking this all very seriously. We saw what happened, in the past 40 days. So I don't think anything should be taken for granted. There's a vetting process that they're all going through. And we hope for the sake of the president and his ability to be effective moving forward, that vetting process is carried out thoroughly.
Pierre Gervais. What does it say about the times we live in, that there are so many billionaires as nominees?
Well, it's interesting because Mr. Denton was actually channeling Andrew Carnegie, who wrote the same thing he said in 1891. So it's not exactly a new idea. And of course, the idea that somebody who runs a business well would run a government well is very arguable. A business is run to make profit. You want to make money. You want to have people work for you to make money. And that's not the goal of government. However, ever since the Gilded Age, for reasons...
The Gilded Age, just for our viewers to remind
people. Sorry, it's the end of the 19th century in the U.S., roughly between 1880 and 1900. And what you have here is really a return to the idea that because somebody builds a business, that somebody will be able to govern. If you think about it 3 minutes, it's really nonsense. This has nothing to do with government.
Nonsense?
Yeah. I mean, of course, a business shouldn't be run like a government. I hope everybody agrees on that. So you really can't run a business like a government, and therefore you cannot run a government like a business either. And if you try to do that, you're just not governing, which is something which didn't happen in the Gilded Age, because the other element which is new here is that really the people who were running the Gilded Age were politicians still. And they were corrupt to a certain extent. They were bought by large companies. But it was not a direct government. This is new. And when we think of conflict of interest, if you think of Elon Musk, for instance, he is in a position now to prevent anybody but himself from developing space industries. He can basically shut out all competitors. And I don't see why he shouldn't if he runs the government like a business.
Before I go to you, Jakob, Jake Denton, you agree with that?
No, not at all. I think, well, when you look at the state of our country, it hasn't really been going so great with the traditional hires.
Yeah, but could Elon Musk now freeze out competitors if he's appointed in this position of power that he's going to have?
He's not being appointed to any position. He's an advisor. You know, maybe they've rebranded the title with this kind of DOGE designation, but functionally, he is just a friend of the administration. He has no statutory authority to box out a competitor. It would still ultimately be at the decision of a secretary or the president himself. And to think that they would be compromised by something like this is ridiculous.
Is it ridiculous, Jakob Hessler?
Well, I think the situation is much more complex in that there is, I think we have in the government or in the likely government, a mix. We have the sort of people who are very convinced by certain highly specific policy ideas. There's Kennedy, there are people from the media sphere, and then there are billionaires. And I think overall today, I don't think that there is a very consistent yet visible program. There's obviously the 2025 program, but there are then as many arguments brought forward as to why the Trump administration would not bring about the 2025 agenda.
Explain what the 2025 agenda
I think we should rather have Mr. Dent, the Heritage Foundation explain. It is, if I understand it correctly, but if I summarize, it's an attempt prior to the election to actually, rather than the first time President Trump was elected, where basically he arrived into office with a very loose political and policy agenda. And I think that project tried to tie in those loose ends and come up with a coherent political vision. One may adhere or not adhere to it, that's a different matter, but to come in and propose a consistent set of policies. Now, the observation, though, is that that consistent set of policies, which are rooted quite strongly in libertarian economics, so economics that are, you could say, sort of the Darwinism type age, the strongest survives, etc., are not always in tune with some of the expectations and desires of some of the more, you know, other electorates of the MAGA sphere. Let's put it that way. But it is an attempt to bring some order and some order into this. And it is clearly a consistent thought through document. Whether or not the Trump administration will implement it, parts of it or not of it, actually, I think probably reflects also President Trump's nature, is that he'll always have several horses running, and he will change and take his bets as a function of his instincts, his intuition, the situation, and where he sees things are going.
Right. So, and the fact that there are so many billionaires, is it a problem, or is it just, well, look, he won and he said he was going to do this, and that's what he's doing?
Well, I don't think that per se, you know, you could say, are there so many billionaires? Are there so many Harvard graduates? Are there so many other Ivy League graduates, or are there? I think the real question is about whether or not the system that is designed to prevent, you know, abuse of power, which has to be in place in all things, whether that system is strong enough. Now, if you have a policy view, and it's not new, remember when, you know, Bloomberg became the mayor of New York, a billionaire who had no clue in how to govern a city, but he came and with a bit of learning became one of the most loved mayors, except that he went from Republican to Democrat, so nobody ever criticized him for being a billionaire. But so I don't think it's per se the problem. The real question I would like to go back is, what are the policies? And are they actually, immigration aside, but on inflation, if you have a high tariff economic policy, the first thing that will do is it will increase prices for products in domestic countries, because the Americans will still buy foreign products. You can't just switch products from one day to the other. So you will increase prices. Now, when you increase prices for goods that many Americans are buying, well, that's called usually inflation. So there is an inherent conflict of objectives. If you believe in strengthening the economy and in strengthening the American economy vis-a-vis China and Russia, there is only so much protectionism that is probably called for. You have allies you need in Asia, you know, that you need to make sure that they can help you against China, etc., etc. And I think, to me, the real question to the administration is, how will they navigate that quite narrow path between making the, you know, historical MAGA people happy and actually you know, driving the agenda of, you know, tech transformation, economic growth, et cetera, et cetera.
And Christine McDaniel, we already saw an initial clash between what Jakob calls the MAGA wing, the nativist supporters of Donald Trump, and the billionaires in the cabinet over how far to go in keeping immigrants out. Do you agree that there's an element of bluff in what Donald Trump says about tariffs?
Well, so a couple things here. First of all, you know, every president usually has some type of plan coming in. So this, the Trump administration, their Project 2025 was fairly comprehensive compared to previous administrations. But over the years, you know, I did some looking, and they have been getting more and more comprehensive over time. Remember, Biden had the, what was it, the Our Street Institute or something looking at this, and that was pretty comprehensive as well, based on their industrial policy, which they really did follow through on, at least in you know, in their attempts. But I don't think that per se is necessarily should be alarming or anything. If anything, it should be quite expected. And presidents sometimes do and sometimes don't follow through on those things. In terms of what Trump is saying, there's I heard the other day that Trump's critics take him literally but not seriously, and then his supporters take him seriously but not literally. I thought that was interesting. So I think we just kind of keep that in mind. You know, he's a self-described performer, and you know, there are certain things that he is very serious about, and if you know, he's trying to get these things done, that means he has to get people to the table, which means he has to get their attention. And tariffs are a tool that it's one of his go-to tools. It definitely has gotten the world's attention. So now the question is, you know, what will they do with that?
Jake Denton, the tariffs, is that just a bargain or is that for real?
Well, we'll just have to wait and see. You know, we're just about a week out from President Trump taking office, and then he'll actually be able to set forth his agenda. I don't really think it's worth speculating on because it's just a little too early to tell. But we have to take him at his word and see what happens.
So right now, on the one hand, tariffs. On the other hand, Pierre Gervais, deregulation, which we saw during Trump's first presidency.
Yeah, I tend to take Trump seriously and literally, both. And I think we all should. I'm surprised by the number of people who think that Trump will not try to do what he wanted to do, or that the teams around here will not try to do what they want to do. And I think they will. Now, some of that, what they want to do, is contradictory. And on that, I agree. But a lot of it points to the same direction, which is essentially the destruction of the American democracy, in so many words, because you don't want, if you're a Republican, you don't want Democrats, whom you consider evil, basically, to be anywhere near power, and you'll make sure that that doesn't happen. So that's the first goal, which will be implemented, I think, or which will certainly be tried to be implemented. The second goal, and that's where we're back to billionaires, which was actually the topic of the debate. Billionaires have a very specific worldview. They don't know about prices. They don't know about, you know, the average American and what they have to pay or not pay. That's not something that your average billionaire will really figure, because it's not in their experience. What is in their experience is what brings more money to themselves and to their group. That's something they can master, which is back to what I was saying. You know, if you see it as a business, you run it as a business. And the goal of a business, again, is not charity. It's not to be nice to people. It's to make money. Now, I think
Michael Bloomberg example?
A lot of these people, Bloomberg was a different animal. He was not in it, so to speak, claiming himself that politics was about running a business. As far as I remember, that was not something he would have been saying.
He ran schools in the beginning like this, and it was a total disaster, having CEOs of companies run New York high schools, and then he put back in normal.
And then he gave up. Bloomberg was not enamored with his own view of what a billionaire is. A lot of the people around Trump have no clue about normal life, and they're also persuaded that they're more clever than everybody else. And that because they built fortunes, often with outside help, actually, from the state specifically, they are in a position to run everything. And also they think that the measure of the efficiency is for the money to keep flowing in. I think that's what we'll see more and more. I think we're going into maybe Putin territory here.
No. Putin territory?
Jakob, I think before we go to that, I think what's important is I think there's a fundamental change, and that's where we go back to the Gilded Ages. I think there's the father of the former UK MP, Jacob Rees-Mogg, wrote a book called The Sovereign Individual, in which he basically describes quite well how the age of information and technology will breed a new generation of people who are sovereign individuals. They use the Nietzsche term. The idea is basically billionaires and mega billionaires will become like states themselves and argue are on the same level. And even the British Commerce Secretary said, oh, we should treat Meta and Google like states. And I think that's where the sort of, in some point, that is a blurry line. I'm not sure that's a very helpful way to think about the common good that, you know, politics or that a society
isn't it the same when you have a Bill Gates who goes to Africa with his foundation?
Of course. It's just that we like him. See, I think if I want to be provocative, what you said about the Republicans trying to keep the Democrats out, the Democrats have done exactly the same the previous 4 years and before. And I think at least parts of the Democrats, and I think the problem is that they weren't honest about it, and they created, and I think the Democrats hurt themselves enormously. They hurt themselves enormously by refusing to acknowledge that when they warned about certain things, really, they were serving their own interest. And I think that has hurt them. It has hurt them because they are now in shambles. They basically committed a collective suicide, no political program, no real consistency, and they're fighting with each other like crazy between progressives and
quickly,
more.
I was talking about tactics, not ideas. Of course, the Democrats don't like the Republicans. That's normal. That's what politics is about. Now, when you prevent the other side from voting or try to, that's different. When you start trying to have coups, that's different. It's a different level of tactics. It's a level of voter suppression, violence, and that's something which the Democrats never
envisioned. And we saw four years
envisioned.
But you use the tools that are at your disposal. So the Republicans would argue now, I'm just, you know, for argument's sake, because this is the debate, would argue, well, the Democrats use the tools at their disposal. They are deeply entrenched in the state, so they use state tools in order to annihilate their opponents. So they sue them in court, they have very politicized justice, et cetera, et cetera.
Pierre Gervais talking about a point here where it brings us to a crossroads between what's good for business, what's good for politics, what's good for democracy. Again, 4 years ago, these captains of industry were all distancing themselves for Donald Trump. And it was startling last week to see that the changing winds in Washington embraced by Mark Zuckerberg, the boss of Meta, which owns Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp. Florent Marché has more.
This week, Facebook announced it would abandon fact-checking, scrap its diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, and appoint a personal friend of Trump to its board of directors, perhaps to curry favor with the incoming U.S. president as CEO Mark Zuckerberg met Trump at Mar-a-Lago on Friday. That evening, Biden slammed Facebook's decision to shun third-party fact-checking on posts.
And the idea that, you know, a billionaire can buy something and say, by the way, from this point on, we're not going to fact check anything. I think it's really shameful.
Zuckerberg already paid Trump a visit in November last year following his election victory, showing possible signs of a post-election rapprochement. Trump had a rocky relationship with American tech companies in the past for his incendiary tone and misleading social media content. Facebook and Twitter banned Trump from their platforms in 2021 following the January 6th Capitol attack.
We believe the risks of allowing the president to continue to use our service during this period are simply too great. Therefore, we're extending the block we have placed on his Facebook and Instagram accounts indefinitely and for at least the next 2 weeks until the peaceful transition of power is complete.
Since then, the U.S. president-elect has built alliances with tech giants in recent years. Despite saying he was unfit for the presidency before Trump's first term, billionaire Elon Musk, the owner of X, has touted himself as a Trump ally since 2022. With Trump's re-election secured, other CEOs have recently taken steps to align themselves with his incoming administration. In parallel with Facebook, Amazon announced it would be cutting some of its DEI initiatives. And CEOs Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos, and Sam Altman each donated $1 million to Trump's inauguration fund. The stars of the tech industry are aligning themselves for Trump as the launch of his second presidency looms.
So they say no man is an island. It's interesting in the case, Christine McDaniel, of Mark Zuckerberg because, I mean, even though his company is publicly listed, he is all powerful on the board. He has this supermajority. And therefore, you know, he's the sole decision maker in all of this.
Yeah. I think that we've kind of seen the pendulum start to swing the other way on DEI initiatives in the U.S. And I think, you know, look, I think that's normal, you know, in a democracy. You know, we try things, you know, we get some things right.
And is January 6th normal?
What?
Is January the 6th normal?
I've never seen that in my lifetime. But, you know, the U.S. has a long and storied past, you know, when it comes to public uprisings. Look, I'm not saying it's right or wrong. All I'm saying is that it shouldn't be that surprising that the pendulum swung pretty far to, you know, pro-DEI initiatives. Some work, some didn't work. You know, I think now it's kind of swinging back to the middle. Let's take what did work, keep that, and then leave the rest. You know, Americans, you know, they don't want to be lectured to on social policies continuously. They want effective government, and they don't like inflation. And so in a way, it doesn't really matter who's in power, if it's a billionaire or a poor middle-income person. They don't want inflation. They want pro-growth. And they want the freedom to be able to, you know, do what they want in life, again, without being lectured to continuously. So I think it matters less how much money is in the bank accounts of our leaders, and it matters more about what they do with that power.
Well, let's take the example of another Silicon Valley appointment. South African-born tech titan David Sacks, named by Trump as artificial intelligence and crypto czar. Sachs, who, along with Musk and others, were part of what's known as the PayPal mafia at the turn of the century, execs who went from that money-sharing site to found other successful tech companies. So he's coming in, Jake Denton, as AI czar, if you will, at a time when there's talk around the world of trying to get global norms, international rules we can all agree on when it comes to artificial intelligence. He has a financial stake in AI for his ventures. Can he be a player and a czar at the same time?
Well, most of these public appointees, these types of things, are forced to put their funds in some form of trust so that they don't have a conflict of interest. But I think what's important here to understand is that David Sacks, along with the whole host of these other titans of industry, have built things of consequence in this country, and they're being put in a position of power to ensure that America can win in the AI competition or in these other spaces against China. And when you talk about these kind of global norms and these global standards, absolutely none of it matters if China wins the AI race, because we will be living under China's rule on the tech frontier. So if you want to have global norms, global standards, a democratic form of AI, it requires America emerging as the leader here in this space. And I think David Sachs will put us in a great situation.
So are you saying when it comes to AI, it's America's way or the highway? Because up to now, there had been what's called the Washington Consensus after World War II, where, yes, the U.S. is the predominant superpower, but there are international norms that are respected and that the U.S. acts as arbiter for. Here you're saying follow the American way and that's it?
Well, I mean, there's some form of realism you have to have here. You know, you look at Europe, they really don't have a competing company. And so when the reality of the market is that you have United States tech companies or Chinese tech companies, there is some form here of it is our way or the highway. And, you know, I think that's for the best. We will emerge as the democratic option for AI, or you can have the authoritarian option in China. But it's a time for choosing, and we're choosing America.
Pierre Gervais?
Well, it's always the same thing. Actually, Elon Musk censored left-wing Twitter accounts when they were attacking him or Trump when he started to work with Trump. So democracy is flexible, let's say. I'm always surprised by the equivalence which is made between, say, a coup attempt and a trial or a coup attempt and a wrong policy. This is not the same thing. These are people who want to keep the power by any means necessary. And I'm quoting this the right way. And when you talk about AI, the idea will be, and all these tycoons going to Mar-a-Lago, the idea will be for them to do politically what Trump wants. And it's sort of a, you know, tit for tat. Eventually, Trump will give them what they want.
Jakob Hessler, artificial intelligence, for it to be successful, it requires a lot of energy because you need a lot of computer servers. Mm-hmm. And it also requires a fair amount of, let's call it theft, of raking whatever you find on the internet, taking people's personal data and using it and recycling it. And you create norms so that it's no longer theft, right? But is that going to happen?
I don't think I think it requires something else, which is hard to do. And I think that is orthogonal as to whether you're Chinese or American. And that's why that race is interesting or important, which is what it takes is that you apply it actually to solve real world problems. Sort of AI in an abstract space has very little value. Yes, it's very smart and you can know even more and you can identify all these insights. But as long as you don't have a business or a government or whatever it is actual use for AI, it is of no value. And that's where that race comes in. It is, how do you regulate? How do you intelligently construct the spaces where, in fact, you can apply it in a way that doesn't endanger democracy, but that creates enough use cases, as you call that, more in tech, that actually allow you to get ahead and deploy it successfully so you gain the benefits. You do not get benefits from just being smart. That's the problem of some of the European AI world, is that they have some of the greatest scientists, some of the greatest AI insights, but where America continuously beats us, I'm afraid to say, is by taking any type of technology and turning it into something that produces a real outcome. And that's where, actually speaking for Europe, I think we need to get much better, is to produce these outcomes. And when you are trying to do that, that's when you get into all these questions of regulation. Can you use people's data? What's the role of privacy? How do you protect democracy? How do you structure human machine interface so as to protect some basic civil liberties, et cetera, et cetera. But it's in these very concrete spaces, I think, that we need to argue them, taking into account the notion of power. And I think Europe at the moment is weak because it has relied a lot on complex regulation in order to solve issues of power. And now we are in a world with Russia, China, and actually a re-emerging more unilateralist US, but that's quite expansionist, where raw power matters more. And I think we in Europe have a hard time adjusting to the reality of hard power. Hard power in terms of military power, but also power in terms of
economic
might. Does
the new European Commission understand that?
I would hope so.
Okay. Christine McDaniel, on things like AI, but also the environment. You know, our sympathies go out to people right now in Los Angeles when they have these fires burning out of control and where people are looking to private companies to help put out fires. Your thoughts on whether these things, again, can be, and some points, solved at a supranational level as the Paris Climate Accords tried to?
Well, that's so much to unpack there. I think the insurance point is really interesting, though. You know, it's statistically efficient to pool risk, but then at some point, you know, it becomes inefficient to keep doing stuff that doesn't work too, right? So it'll be interesting to see if they do end up rebuilding in these same places or if there are any changes, because the rest of the country is already facing higher insurance rates for houses, homeowner insurance, and it'll be interesting to see the consumer backlash if rates keep rising and then they see these people rebuilding these huge homes in very risky places. But that's sort of a side note. What was your other question? Sorry.
No, it was a question of whether or not, you know, is there still room for a multilateral world on issues like the environment?
Well, look, I mean, as an economist, carbon emissions, to the extent that is a negative externality, and, you know, we're not pricing it in, right? And we know that the least costly way to deal with that is to put a price on it, right? So the market, and it should be a market determined price. And because carbon emissions flow across borders, it kind of needs to be a global market. But I think we're way, way, way a long way off from doing anything like that, for better or worse, which leads us to a second, third, fourth best world. And that's where countries are now. Are they going to do border adjustment taxes or subsidies?
But my question is more pointed. Are things like UN climate summits a waste of time or in this new age that we live in? Or should we keep on doing them?
In terms of from the U.S. perspective, it does not seem like the incoming administration is that keen to keep that at the very top of the priority list. And we have to remember, U.S. Congress, especially the Senate, U.S. Senate has never really been that keen on signing away any sovereignty. I mean, even signing on to the Uruguay round, you know, WTO was a big stretch, if you go back and read those minutes. So it doesn't seem like it's at the top of the priority list for the United States.
So, Jake Denton, there's nothing the U.S. can't solve on its own?
Correct. Yeah, I mean, we have all the tools at our disposal. It's just a question of if we can get out of our own way. You know, you look at the state of affairs here, the middle of our country has been gutted down to its bones. You look at the coasts where we've been ravaged by storms and all sorts of things. It's time to rebuild, and we can clear out all of these types of burdensome regulatory policies that prevent us from building and restore our country to greatness.
And so hold on a sec. Doable. There's just been big fires in California, and isn't regulation to prevent this kind of occurrence from happening again, when thought on zoning more important? You're saying get rid of all the rules?
I mean, the fire was started in the hillside. The biggest burden here was not some form of zoning policy. It was the absence of forest management. In that respect, you know, we absolutely need to get involved. But it has been a shortcoming of this administration in particular from actually clearing these forests, from giving states like California the resources that they need to prevent these fires. And so really, it's a testament to bureaucratic incompetence in the state of California that we're dealing with $1 billion worth of damage. Yes, we can absolutely rebuild to glory and also, you know, not have fires. Both are doable at the same time.
You don't get something for nothing, Pierre Gervais.
That's a problem. There is a slight...
You can't lower taxes and give
There is
money.
A slight contradiction there. Actually trying to fix the environmental problem in California was requiring huge amounts of money, which neither the Californian governor, that's true, or the Democratic governor, or the Democratic administration, or much less the Republicans, wanted to invest, because these are a lot of money. And nobody wants to do that. And a lot of things like that in the U.S. would require a lot of investment, but investment needs to come from somewhere. And given that the current future Republican administration doesn't want most of its billionaires to wear their fair share of the tax burden, it's very unlikely that this investment will take place. So it will go on burning. Also, it will go on burning more and more because climate change is happening. It's not only a matter of firefighters. If nothing is done about it, you can put all the firefighters you want in. With Santa Ana winds the way they are in the middle of January, any cigarette butt can basically burn down Los Angeles at that point.
All right. So you talked earlier about the Gilded Age. And and in 2025, we're wondering, are imbalances sustainable? Let's look back to history. A Gilded Age cartoon from Joseph Kepler in 1889, yes, entitled Bosses of the Senate. And it shows the robber baron captains of industry as owning the lawmakers you see in the upper house of the U.S. Capitol. At the same time, you wonder, are we in the Gilded Age or are we in the Roaring Twenties? 100 years ago this week, the then U.S. President Calvin Coolidge told a conference of journalists, the chief business of the American people is business. They are profoundly concerned with producing, buying, selling, investing, and prospering in the world. He, Christy McDaniel, was wildly popular as president. Of course, we know with hindsight what happened 4 years later with the stock market crash, which triggered a rethink of the role of government. Are we in 1925 right now?
I hope not. They do say history repeats itself, but I don't know. I don't know. I think the premise, focusing so much on the billionaire thing, I don't know if that's really fair. I mean, think of how much George Soros, how much influence George Soros has had during Democratic administrations, even the last administration, or these humongous foundations, that are founded by the wives of billionaires. So I don't know. I don't really buy the billionaire, non-billionaire thing. I think people with deep pockets always find ways to influence, whether they're in, sitting in the chair or not. So, and look, in the U.S., we have a democracy. If Trump can't solve inflation, then it's hard to see, the next person he would love to see succeed him, whether that's J.D. Vance or whatever, be successful. So I'm cautiously optimistic. America voted him in, give him 4 years, see what he can do. But if that means higher prices and Americans seeing their paycheck go, less and less far, then it's hard to see another 4 years of someone like Trump, or his successor, have the wheel.
Jacob Hessler, deregulation, lower taxes, tariffs, it'll work until it won't. You agree?
Well, that's obviously always true. I think the interesting Gilded Age comparison is actually, in the Gilded Age, they built railroads, crazy railroads, the Vanderbilts against the Fisks, against the gold, competing against each other in a good way. You could say it's probably not useful to have two parallel railway tracks linking two cities. They did so, mm-hmm. And a lot of savers, in that case English, UK savers, lost a lot of money. And you could say in a certain way today, that is, you have, I don't know how many AI, large language models competing with billion-dollar valuations. Most of them are American, some are European, some are Chinese, but it will gamble out. So there's going to be one or two that's going to remain. And the bet is, I guess, that at least one of them is going to be American, probably the biggest one, given how many they are. That is probably a likely outcome. And let's not forget the age that followed the Gilded Age was a huge era of progressivism.
Yep.
So you may, you know, as the pendulum that was described, it's going to swing back again. I think as long as the house doesn't burn down, I think it's just going to swing back. And we're going to go through a period that may some people not find nice, but then there'll be another period and that and other
it,
people won't
it
find
all
nice.
Starts.
And if it doesn't work, you can always invade Canada.
And it all starts 1 week from today with the inauguration, which we'll cover right here on France 24. I want to thank you, Jakob Hessler. I want to thank Pierre Gervais, Jake Denton for being with us from Washington, Christine McDaniel from the Washington suburb of Arlington, Virginia. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 today.
Cette semaine, le Paris des Arts pose ses caméras en Guadeloupe pour aller à la rencontre d'une ambassadrice de la musique antillaise, Tania Saint-Val.
Je suis profondément antillaise, profondément caribéenne. Donc je suis vraiment une chanteuse de zouk, avec un père chanteur, avec une maman qui travaillait dans une boutique de disques à l'époque, ce qui fait l'artiste que je suis aujourd'hui.
Nous nous inviterons également à la table du chef cuisinier Jimmy Bibra qui sublime dans l'assiette les saveurs locales. Et puis à la fin de l'émission, un coup de cœur, ou plutôt un coup de projecteur sur le street artiste Al Pacman. Le Paris des Arts, émission spéciale en Guadeloupe, à ne surtout pas manquer sur France 24.